The World War II myth of Radio Tokyo disc jockey Tokyo Rose, and the real Japanese-American woman that myth was tagged upon, Iva Tsuguri. That's our focus on this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
Iva Tsuguri, the California-born and educated Nisei, is still around Tokyo, living in a hovel outside the capital, seeking only to be forgotten as the Japanese want to forget. 10 days ago, she had this to say to Burton Crane, mutual correspondent.
I'm one of those persons who hope that we can forget the past, and I have a lot of it to forget and concentrate on the future. Can't we let bygones be bygones?
We're making an historical record, and it wouldn't be complete without the voice of Tokyo Rose.
Sometimes I think that most history should be forgotten.
I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you've done. I'll bet you're sorry that you went to work for that old rising sun. You stuck a knife into the USA. You forgot what they learned you at UCLA. I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you... Sorry for what you've done.
An excerpt from an August 4, 1947 Mutual Radio Network broadcast concerning Iva Tsuguri Dakino, the woman generally identified as the mythical Tokyo Rose, and a July 9, 1947 recording of comedian Abe Burrows singing his hit novelty song, I Bet You're Sorry Now, Tokyo Rose. There are two facts to keep in mind while you listen to this program as they pertain to events in the years since the most recent recordings I'll be playing this week. Firstly, in January 1977, as his final act as President of the United States, Gerald Ford issued a pardon for Iva Tsuguri, setting aside her 1949 conviction on making treasonous broadcasts for Japan during the Second World War. The pardon, however, did not restore to her the $10,000 that she was fined, and could not return to her the 7 years of her life she had been imprisoned. Secondly, at the time of the production of this program, on the 2nd of June 2006, Iva Tsuguri is still alive, residing in the Chicago metropolitan area, and will, in 1 month and 2 days, celebrate her 90th birthday, on the 4th of July. There was never an actual Tokyo Rose, that name being a nickname applied to a series of female disc jockeys who broadcast 1930s American swing music to Allied troops in the Pacific during a propaganda series on Radio Tokyo called The Zero Hour. The myth that arose from these broadcasts became so popular amongst American troops that, on the 8th of February 1946, Paramount Pictures released a film titled Tokyo Rose, with Lotus Long portraying the mythical disc jockey. At the time the movie came out, American citizen Iva Tsuguri Dakino, she had married a Portuguese national named Felipe Dakino, whom she would eventually divorce, was prisoner number one at Sugamo Prison. It would be this woman upon which the mythical image would forever be placed. In an early documentary piece, broadcast journalist Bill Curtis allowed Iva Tsuguri to tell her own story of how she had come to be known as Tokyo Rose. The interview was conducted on November the 4th, 1969.
The war in the Pacific is moving toward Japan. Guadalcanal, Tarawa, names in the world atlas before, now household words. Only the strongest memories remain. Memories of battle and boredom. and rare moments of relief, like a softly feminine voice from Radio Tokyo.
Hello, you fighting orphans of the Pacific. How strict. This is After Her Weekend, Annie, back on the air strictly under UN hours. Reception okay? Well, it better be, because this is all request night. And I've got a pretty nice program for my favorite little family, the wandering boneheads of the Pacific Islands. The first request is made by none other than the boss. And guess what? He wants Bonnie Baker. And my resistance is low. My, what taste you have, sir, she said.
That somewhat garbled program provided the Allied troops with a feminine voice and popular music. Orphan Anne on the Zero Hour, playing music for her wandering orphans in the Pacific. But she and other women broadcasters for Japan were known to the GIs as Tokyo Rose.
Well, thank you. That's all for now, enemies, but there'll be more of the same tomorrow night. Until then, this is Orphan Anne, your number one enemy, reminding you GIs always to be good. Goodbye now.
In reality, there never was a program or person named Tokyo Rose. There were women broadcasters, nearly 20 of them, who played music and talked to the troops in the Pacific, and most probably broadcast propaganda. Tokyo Rose was the GI name for all of these female voices on Radio Tokyo. But when the war ended, history would have a single Tokyo Rose. She would become the first woman convicted of treason in the United States, but for 20 years would continue to profess innocence, living a silent life, branded a traitor, but feeling like a patriot. This is her story. How many people would rewrite their lives if at age 24 they had the knowledge of what would happen in the next 29 years? Iva Dacchino would. She would change her life beginning with a trip to Japan, because it marked the beginning of a series of circumstances which would tear her life apart.
Well, I had gone over there to visit a sick aunt, my mother's only living sister. And my mother couldn't go because she was ill herself. She asked me to go and to see how her sister was, plus take her some things that she needed, because they were very short of material things, because Japan had been at war with China for so long. So this is what I did. I went over there to visit the aunt.
She was caught between two countries at war. This is the story of a woman who maintained American citizenship while broadcasting for the Japanese, who denies the label Tokyo Rose, and denies ever having broadcast propaganda, but who was convicted of treason. Iva Dacchino was born in California, 1916, on the 4th of July. Her father was a citizen of British Columbia, her mother of Japanese descent. Medical research was her main interest, and she graduated from UCLA with a degree in zoology. It was in July of 1941 that, according to Japanese custom, she became the family representative at the expected death of an aunt in Japan. Japan's relations with the United States were frayed that summer, and Iva sought passage back home. But when she applied to the State Department for a passport to return to the United States, it was denied. The State Department sent word saying her citizenship had not been proven. It was an obvious mistake, since her later trial for treason was based on her U.S. citizenship. But fateful. It came 1 month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The Japanese, however, considered her a citizen of the United States, and she was immediately under the surveillance of an internal security force in Japanese Kempe Tai. Her aunt, having recovered, feared retaliation for harboring an American citizen, and Mrs. Dacchino was turned out on the street to hunt for new quarters and a job. She took small ones until the fall of 1943, when there was an opening in Radio Tokyo for a typist.
The war started. There was very little work that I could do, since I did not know the Japanese language, and all I knew was typing in English. So I got a job as a typist at Radio Tokyo. And after I'd been there for some time, the head of the department said, we have an order from the exact translation would be General Army Headquarters, I guess, saying that you were to participate in a broadcast with the Allied prisoners of war who are being not used, but they are running a program here at Radio Tokyo, and you have been ordered to broadcast with the Allied prisoners of war, and this is how it started. I had never seen a mic before, but the head of the department said that the Allied prisoners of war had selected me, and they wanted me to work with them to put on this particular program.
You were an enemy alien at the time.
That's right, I was.
What were some of the scripts that you read?
Well, the scripts actually, they were like just introductions to music and giving some information on the content of the music, plus sort of asking the listeners to join in a sing-song thing and sort of a get-together program type of script. But the Allied Prisoners of War, they wrote all the scripts. They were, of course, pros at it, and they were able to prepare the scripts in such a way that it was entertaining and humorous without any of this so-called material which is attributed, you know, to this particular broadcast. A very free, easygoing, fun type of program.
She participated in 340 of those zero-hour broadcasts, and their value as propaganda is in question. Across the Pacific, if that value was measured by a decline in Allied morale, it was utter failure. Most GIs laughed at the programs. Many enjoyed them. Some said they could detect the weather conditions over Tokyo, useful if you were going to bomb it. In later testimony, Japanese authorities said that from their Tokyo headquarters, they decided the object of the Zero Hour was to cause the Allied troops to become homesick and disgusted with the war. One said it was entertainment only. Some Allied prisoners of war who participated in the programs testified they saw it as a chance to dilute the Japanese propaganda effort. They testified that they asked Iva to join their team. They could trust her.
Oh, I got along very well with the prisoners of war. It's a very strange feeling to see that there were Allied prisoners of war who were forced to broadcast, and they welcomed talking to someone from the United States, although the prisoners of war, there was one from the Philippines and one from Australia. They were all liked to talk about the States and the progress of the war. Some of the news I was able to get because through an agency where my later husband was working, we were able to get the intercepted Allied news, and I was able to take the news over to the prisoners of war.
What were you able to do for the Allied prisoners of war?
Well, not much, but I was able to supplement whatever, their diet with what little I could get them. Whatever was available in the vitamin pills and fruit, of which they ate seeds, skin, and all because of the danger of pellagra. And they were short of, blankets and things, and I used to take the blankets to them, and they used to take them under their coats and take them into the prisoners of war camp after their broadcast. Many times there were the prisoners who were having malaria attacks, and they couldn't get enough blankets. So I used to take in blankets, and they used to take them in for me.
There were some 20 women broadcasting for Radio Tokyo. What was the phrase? They all look alike? But did they all sound alike? This was Orphan Anne, a The recording is an actual broadcast.
Greetings, everybody. This is your number one enemy, your favorite playmate, Orphan Anne, a radio soldier. The little sunbeam whose throat you'd like to touch. We're ready again for a vicious assault on your morale. 75 minutes of music and news for our friends, I mean our enemies in the South Pacific.
On the same zero-hour broadcast, this female voice was introduced as Dutchie.
Greetings and salutations to my dear friends in Saipan and all points north and south in the Pacific. This is Dutchie and Company with classic music for classic lounge.
This multiple voice broadcasting led to the description of Tokyo Rose as a composite of several women. When the war ended, although no one either in Japan or among the Allied forces really knew who she was, Tokyo Rose was as much a symbol of Japan as Tojo, or Slant Eyes. And Iva Dakino, the only American among the broadcasters who had not given up her U.S. citizenship, became Tokyo Rose.
Well, one of the fellows in charge, who incidentally was born and raised here, his wife had been as a substitute broadcaster on this so-called zero-hour broadcast. And when the Army or the CIC went to Radio Tokyo to search for someone to be associated with this image, he more or less directed them over to me to get them off of his back.
Japan was a defeated nation. Food was scarce, occupation government ruled, there was total confusion.
I was put in jail for over a year in Japan.
By U.S. authorities?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Under charges of treason there?
No specific charges. I was just dragged off and put in jail and just left there. Everybody forgot about me. I couldn't get any legal help or no counsel of any kind. And at the same time, I was questioned all the time, almost daily, by all different branches of the United States government, civil government, and the Army.
Were you released at all from jail?
Yes, after completion of over a year, they released me under orders from General MacArthur's headquarters. And I understood that General Willoughby's orders stated that there was no evidence whatsoever to connect me with this case, and so they released me.
Specifically, that government release order said the Department of Justice no longer desires Iva Dakino be retained in custody. October 6, 1946. Upon that release, she applied for a passport to the United States. Some say it was a radio broadcast in 1948 by Walter Winchell, prompted by a Gold Star mother that brought pressure upon the Justice Department to reopen the case. Others feel it was the work of two journalists, Harry Brundage and Clark Lee. They allegedly had interviewed Tokyo Rose and obtained information which they turned over to the Justice Department. Although none of the prisoners of war who wrote the programs had been prosecuted, one had even been promoted. In 1948, after a year in jail, Iva was arrested again, this time charged with 8 counts of treason. She was tried in San Francisco.
The trial? Well, they covered 13 weeks, and there's just a multitude of witnesses that appeared whom I've never seen before, I never heard of before, and yet they profess to have known me, they testified that they saw the broadcast, heard the broadcast, which was impossible because the Allied prisoners of war were under guard, and they couldn't have got into the studio. But they all testified that they heard me, say these things, and they saw me actually perform. So many of the witnesses were brought over here, I suppose, right after the war, and the people, when they were asked to come, they were willing to come because they were given so much per diem, and 3 meals a day, and a trip to the United States, and a lot of people just jumped at it. Didn't make any difference what sort of a witness they would make.
The indictment charged that her activities were intended to destroy the confidence of the members of the armed forces of the United States and their allies in the war effort, to undermine and lower American and allied military morale, and to impair the capacity of the United States to wage war against its enemies. Over 13 weeks, there were hours of testimony, much of it conflicting. The government presented 46 witnesses, the defense 44, 19 by deposition. The prosecution argued that she worked to create nostalgia and war weariness among the members of the armed forces to discourage them. The defense tried to show that she was part of a team working to water down the Japanese effort, that she broadcast under duress. The jury of six men and six women came back once from deliberation unable to reach agreement. The judge urged them to try again. After 5 days, they brought in a verdict. Innocent on 7 counts, guilty on 1. That on a day during October 1944, she did speak into a microphone concerning the loss of ships.
And you went to jail for how many years?
About 6 years. Time off for good behavior.
Yes. And you still have a fine to pay.
Yes, I do. I still had that fine which was placed on me.
At any time did you feel that you were collaborating with the enemy or that your acts were treasonous?
No, I never felt that. I guess it's mainly because at the onset when the Allied prisoners of war placed their whole program in front of me and they said that they wanted me to become a member of their team and wanted to put on their type of program and so that they could send these messages home. This is the only way they could send the messages home to their, you know, to the other parents to let them know that they were living.
And that is not collaborating in your...
Well, no, I felt that I was working with them and helped them do what they tried to do in an enemy country for their own purpose.
You were, you are now, and you remained at that time an American citizen, didn't you?
Yes, I did. It was... pretty rough at times because it was a very easy procedure to become a citizen of Japan. All you had to do was sign in an award, and that would have prevented all of this. If I had any feeling that it was going to hit me like it did, I would have just gone and signed in and become a citizen of Japan and not be liable.
Chicago, a long way from a broadcast studio in Japan or the war, a trial and prison. With time off for good behavior, Mrs. Dacchino came here in 1956. There is a small Japanese-American community, and she worked in a shop. She could seek anonymity among friends. Father was here. Her mother had died during the war in a relocation camp for Japanese-Americans, Nisei, in Gila River, Arizona. Her work and family became her life. They had their own problems of relocation during the war, and the family knew nothing of what had happened to their daughter. Today, she feels it may have been hardest on them.
We're all rather stoic, so I think this characteristic is the thing that has sort of bound us together, and they've been very loyal. And I'm very proud of them. I really don't hold any bitterness. I don't think it's very healthy. Number one, and I think you gain nothing from being bitter.
But lack of bitterness does not mean lack of feeling, and now she can relive it like some Monday morning quarterback.
Actually, looking back, when you analyze something like this, you feel that, if I had any fear of guilt after my initial release, from the army, you know, the army was in control then. Since I had been married to a Portuguese national, I could have been free from any charges by becoming a Portuguese citizen. And in fact, the Portuguese consul offered me free transportation to any possession of Portugal. And he said, no, I'm not running away from anything. And I kept my citizenship. So I believe that a leopard just doesn't change his spots.
So for Iva Dacchino, despite the years, it's hard to forget. But harder still to resist speculation about a slightly different set of circumstances. Would she be convicted today?
I don't know anything about law. You know, but with reading so many decisions handed down by the Supreme Court in the last, say, 5 years, it seems that so the points of law that protect the individual has been, I don't know whether it's been clarified or laxed, or I don't know the correct terminology, but the reason why I mention this is I assumed all the time that anyone charged with a capital crime is certainly has a right to legal counsel, and which I never did have until I came back to San Francisco. I think there's a span of, what, 3 or 4 years after the cessation of war in 45. It was about 4 years subsequent to that that the trial actually began. So
okay.
I have reason to believe there's a lot of opinions formed, you know, in that time. You have to sell newspapers, you have to sell magazines.
Iva D'Aquino is in Chicago. She works in a small store. She has a circle of friends. She's quiet, and while she would like her side of the story told for a change, the thought of cameras and lights is frightening. She remembers the other times there were cameras and lights. Her attorneys are still fighting and urge her to speak out more. But as she says, they're in San Francisco, and that's easy to say. But life is comfortable. If that were all, there could be no complaint. But that's not all. The present is comfortable. It is the past that's troublesome. And for Mrs. D'Aquino, the past is the present and the future. Iva D'Aquino will be remembered because the story of Tokyo Rose will not be forgotten. It is a memory of a generation caught in a world war. It is one of those comfortable pieces of history pigeonholed into its proper place. The case is closed for everyone except Iva D'Aquino. The truth lies somewhere in the nagging dissimilarity between a legendary Oriental siren of the Pacific and a bookkeeper in Chicago 2 wars later.
Bill Curtis interviewing Iva Toguri on November the 4th, 1969. What you are about to hear is the recording as received at a Federal Communications Commission listening post of an actual zero-hour program that Iva Toguri appeared on. It is presented here within the context of the segments that immediately led into and followed hers. This recording was played back at her trial, but was not the one she was convicted of making. Perhaps ominous is the fact that this program was transmitted by Radio Tokyo over their shortwave station JLP on 15.325 megahertz to the Pacific Islands on August 14, 1944, exactly 1 year before the Japanese government announced it was surrendering to end the Second World War.
This is the 0 hour calling on the Pacific. And for the next 75 minutes, we're going to take you through music as you like it, sweet and harsh and otherwise. Music from all over the world and a thought for the day. Sometimes even 2 thoughts for the day. First, let's have the fighting news for the fighting men.
Although the bulk of the fighting on the Western Front is still in the area between Dives and Seven Rivers, the center of gravity of the Allied offensive at present is more massed than before in the mobile wing of the American Army operating between Normandy and Loire. The 1st Canadian Army has been trying to accomplish a breakthrough between Orne and Dives. The Allied pressure in Normandy was brought to bear partly with the intention of tying down the bulk of the German counter thrust in the area south of Seine Bay. The 3rd United States Army pushed forward its motorized spearhead with strong air force support from middle of the south eastward in order to cut off the German communication. The American units from Nantes and Angers appeared to be moving forward towards the Loire. In Brittany, the Allies redoubled its efforts to take the fortified coastal places. Fierce fighting is going on for Lorient and Offbret. In Saint-Malo, the German garrison is continuing to offer heroic resistance. There was no noticeable change in the battle line between the Saloon River and the area south of Vire. The battle continues north and northeast of Falaise. Here, Canadian attacks were met by German troops with stubborn resistance. In Italy, no major operations took place on Saturday. And the Eastern Front, of several Soviet attacks between Kursk and the Big Vistula Bend were warded off and numerous Soviet tanks destroyed. The Luftwaffe carried out several successful raids on Soviet tank columns west of Baranov. Northwest of Bialystok, further breakthrough attempts by more than Soviet divisions were checked in a grim battle, as were all Soviet thrusts in Latvia. Southwest of Lake Pleskow, on the other hand, the Soviets succeeded in enlarging their penetrations. On the Indo-Burma front, the Japanese forces inflicted tremendous blows on the enemy troops of over 30,000 in battles around Mitikina. Within a period of 5 months up to the end of July, the enemy suffered the loss of more than 15,000 men, including those killed, wounded, and taken prisoner. In the Pacific, our garrison on Chichijima Island in the Ogasawara repulsed on Saturday an enemy formation of 16 four-engine bombers, which came to raid the island. At dawn the same day, 16 enemy fighters attempted to raid Wurpji Island in the Marshalls, but were beaten back by our interceptors.
You have just heard the fighting news of the fighting men. This is the 0 hour calling in the Pacific.
Heard about the trouble we had, boss?
What trouble?
You remember Frank Waterlady?
Yeah, we had him Saturday.
Well, he was on again last night.
How come?
He busted right in on the news.
You're not allowed. That's against the rules.
Well, that went out anyway.
Hey, Gus, sit up a little bit. In the meantime, we bring you Anne and her playmate, the orphan.
Weekend, Annie, back on the air strictly under UN hours. Is that okay?
Well, it better be, because this is all request night. And I've got a pretty nice program for my favorite little family, the wandering boneheads of the Pacific Islands. The first request is made by none other than the boss. And guess what? He wants Bonnie Baker.
And my resistance is low.
My, what taste you have, sir, she said.
So sweet and so divine. Oh, but you've got me never came to new love, and it's taken full possession of my mind. I like to go to dances or a movie with you, but you just want to park the car and lift your little roof. I like to say no, make you let me go. Oh, but my resistance is so low.
And now that hat will be passed. The second request is sent in by a roaming bonehead of an orphan, request number 29. He wants Tony Martin, of all people, to help him forget the mosquitoes and dirty writing. Well, you know, obliging Annie, Tony Martin, and Now It Can Be Told. For some, Russell cleaning for some, and for the others, just another day to play. Let's all get together and forget those wash day goods. Here's Kay Kaiser, Sally Mason, and all the playmates. So come join the parade, you bonehead.
Oh, playmate, come out and play with me. Thank you.
such a sunny day. With a tearful eye, she breathed a sigh, and I could hear her say, I'm sorry, Pokemon. I cannot play with you. My darling, have the flu. Ain't got no rainbow, ain't got no cellar door, but we'll be childhood friends just forevermore.
My little playmate, come out and play with me, and bring your doll with me to the pampa tree. Look down my window, tie down my shoe.
Request of the evening. Oh, come on, don't hold back, Betty. What is it you want to hear? Don't be bashful.
Can you oblige with My Heart Belongs to Daddy? Be Wayne doing the vocal, of course.
Well, no sooner said than done.
But when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to Daddy. If I invite a boy some night to dine on my fine feminine heavy, I just adore his asking for more. But my heart belongs to daddy. Yes, my heart belongs to daddy. So I simply couldn't be bad. Yes, my heart belongs to daddy. So I want to warn you, laddie, though I know you're perfectly swell, that my heart belongs to daddy, 'cause my daddy, he treats me so well.
According to Union Hours, we are through today. We close up another chapter of Sweet Propaganda in the form of music for you, for my dear little orphans wandering in the Pacific.
There are plenty of non-unionists coming around the corner, so be seeing you tomorrow. But in the meanwhile, always remember to be good, and so...
Goodbye now.
Goodbye.
I thought the party was divine. I spent the evening forgetting the time. I can't deny. Oh, now goodbye. Goodbye now.
Goodbye.
Goodbye now.
Goodbye.
The trip by taxi wasn't far. We'd linger longer if I had a car. No use to cry. And now goodbye. There's one advantage to our leaving. It brings about a special kiss. I hope that there'll be eternally a momentary parting, just a second. Then we're starting. Oh, goodbye now.
Goodbye.
Goodbye now.
Goodbye.
It's just a moment we're apart.
Conference, he said, is a question for future determination. Roosevelt said he will report to the nation on his Pacific trip, his first war journey. He said he has no time for political campaign in the usual sense, but said that he would report to the people from time to time. Roosevelt ordered the seizure of Midwest truck companies involved in an 8-day strike, and that they will be operated by the Office of Defense Transportation until the dispute is settled. The War Labor Board, which found itself powerless to solve the controversy in which 108 companies refused to pay a directed 7 cents an hour wage increase, one whole day was spent on the fire that licked the Hudson River Pier at New Jersey. Firemen still battled the flaming wave Saturday night. Police and officials of the fire department now announced that the damage exceeded millions of dollars. The dockmen suffered minor injuries while battling the fire. The police department reports that the fire started from one of the drums when one of the drums of the oils which were being loaded caught fire. Uh-oh, Army practice bombers dropped something on the ground in Florida when the mechanical releasing device suddenly went haywire. The planes on practice bombing mission dropped several bombs which fell behind the target, and what do you think happened? 4 civilians were killed and 5 others injured. Well, what can you expect in this day and age? The Australian war brides have arrived in San Francisco, forming the largest contingent of Australian wives of American servicemen. There were 296 wives carrying 72 babies. Australian forces have announced that there's plenty more, a larger number than there were in 1942. Already some 200 babies of these brides have traveled to the United States. Another batch of 134 brides are awaiting transportation, and 200 others have applied for permits to enter the United States.
I have just heard the news highlights for tonight. This is the Zero Hour calling in the Pacific. We've had it sweet, and now...
Hey, boss, what are we going to do about Watanabe?
Have you received any protests from the International Red Cross?
That's just what I'm worried about.
Better be careful next time he's around.
Iva Tuguri as disc jockey Orphan Anne on the Zero Hour over Radio Tokyo on August 14, 1944. One final note here. In 2004, actor George Takei announced plans to make a film of Tuguri's life during the Second World War. The title of the projected film was announced by Takei as being Tokyo Rose, American Patriots. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2006. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio, on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.